I'm going to talk pretty quickly. I'm going to move through my slides pretty fast since we'll have time to discuss, and I don't want to go over. So I'm going to talk about really what's been a career project for me 25 plus years. So it's kind of a long story, and I'm going to make it real short. And talk a little bit about challenges, and importantly, the progress we've made in breeding broccoli adapted to high temperatures. So just as a little reminder, broccoli falls under the species Brassica oleracea. It's the broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, all same species. This is called the variety. We call the really botanical groups of varieties is Italica, is broccoli. It now has emerged as really the most important of the species in the U.S. It has a farm gate value something approaching $900 million. It's a crop for which private industry now supplies almost exclusively F1 hybrid varieties for production. And it's a vegetable which has undergone dramatic increases in consumption since the 70s. And really, in the early 60s, we probably ate about a pound per person per year, and now we're somewhere in the range of 8 to 9 pounds per person a year. So it's close to a tenfold increase. It's probably one of the a vegetable that sees more of an increase in consumption than most in the U.S. Market. So California historically grows about 80 to 85%. Actually, if you consider California and then the desert going into Yuma, and that would be more the largest share of the broccoli. But they don't do it by producing in only one area. They ship production throughout the year to depending on what the climate is at that given position. It was first introduced on the East Coast, so that's important. It probably spent probably the first 20 years or so on the East Coast. It was introduced, I believe, by Italian gardeners around the turn of the last century. And so it jumped to the West around the middle of the 20th century, and then where it has dominated for the last 50 or 60 years. So we've always postulated that year-round production in the East is possible, but it's mostly limited by high temperature spikes, or really in general by unpredictable weather patterns that we have in the East compared to certain environments in the West, where at least depending on where you are, it's predictable. So if you see where the largest production in the West, it shifts, okay? In the winter, you've got that area down in the south in Arizona and the Imperial Valley. And then the Central Valley is inland. They're growing broccoli. They can in the spring and the fall. And then it's those coastal valleys, Santa Maria and Salinas, which has a fairly steady climate year-round. In those areas, you could grow it almost any time of the year. Now, in the east, we do have now significant pockets like northern Maine. They're growing it in the middle of the summer. And in northern Florida, now we've got significant production going on in the middle of the winter. And then you do have significant pockets. We're not 100% sure how much acreage has increased in the last 10 years or so, but we know the number of farms that are actually growing broccoli has increased. The acreage is always total in the U.S., you're looking at about 130,000 acres of broccoli. So this is kind of the epitome of a modern broccoli. You got a very dense head. You know, this is a premature flowering stalk that we eat. It's got a dome shape. It's dense. The buds that we actually eat, we call them beads. You got a very small, relatively small bead size, and a very uniform bead size across the surface of the head. So I guess maybe in some ways I was a gambling person, and when I started my job in the early 90s, I thought there was definitely a lot of interest in trying to breed broccoli for heat tolerance, and maybe a lot of people were doing it at some scale, so, you know, I took that on being in South Carolina in an area where we did have a very hot environment. I took on the task of seeing if I could actually carry out this hypothesis to breed broccoli adapted to high temperature environments and that will produce high quality heads. The temperatures exceed 30. That's sort of like a benchmark high temperature we're talking about. So one of the first questions you have to, when you're going to breed for somebody, is you got to start to understand what's your abiotic stress, what's the effect of it. And so most conventional broccoli requires, people don't think about this, but requires vernalization. It's not like cabbage or some of the greens, which you have to go down to, you know, just above freezing for a period of weeks. You got to hit 22 or 23 degrees C. So you got to have some night temperatures that are cool. That's an important lesson that we learned along the way. Responses to temperatures greater than 30, mainly you get a distortion of the head. You get leaves in the head, distorted shape, discoloration, uneven bead size. And, of course, because of that vernalization, you can also not get a head at all. So high temperatures have the most negative effect when broccoli is undergoing a shift from vegetative to reproductive. Broccoli may actually be pretty tolerant of high temperatures, vegetatively speaking. They can grow, well, I'll show you, they grow very fast in the summer. But it's when they're trying to make that shift is when the cool temperatures are important. And so if you're in a high temperature condition, this is the kind of, give you a few examples of the kind of things you see. Just a very, it hardly looks like broccoli, pretty ugly. Uneven beads, or some areas didn't even form beads. You get sort of things that stay cauliflower-like. They don't make that transition to those more mature beads. You get all these bracteae or leaves in the head, very common. Or it has a hard time, it just can't quite make a head. It just makes a small little head. You know, it just doesn't quite look like broccoli. So these are very common for a lot of conventional broccolis. And or it just doesn't, it just stays vegetative. It can't make the shift. And that's where you're not vernalizing the crop. And what happens with a lot of these is they actually, it's almost like apical dominance breaks down and you get all kinds of lateral growth on these plants. People ask, could that eventually make a head? And probably not, because apical dominance is so disrupted by heat in some cases. So the selection environment I decided to operate in, so this is Julian date on the bottom, about 150 is the end of May. So the key point is here, we transplant around the last week of May. That's where we're at now. We started sometime later than that, but now we go last week of May. By the time we get to, I think there's almost like a juvenile effect in the brassicas, so we're about the first 3 to 4 weeks, a temperature has minimal effect. But when we get about past that 30-day mark, you see we're always, our night temperatures don't go below that 22, 23 C. So what we end up doing is eliminating all those things that are required to be vernalized, and we end up ultimately with a pool that was insensitive on that front and can make a head. So I started around 93, 94. I grew all the commercial material I could get my hands on. Very little PI material in the U.S., so we were dealing largely with commercial varieties. And luckily at that time, they were nearly all fertile. So we could look at commercial hybrids, and we could self them down. Most were protected by trade secrets, so you couldn't really steal a hybrid, but you could self them and make your own inbreds. Everybody did that at that time. But we only really found about 5 to 7 that have potential at that time. And Green Comet is one of the early F1 hybrids developed in 1968. This is one that actually made a head. It's not fantastic, but it was making a head. It was sizable. It was lacking some of the flaws. Paragon, another kind of an obscure hybrid. Again, it's not really pretty, but it had something. So we thought, okay, let's work with these hybrids. And sure enough, the first things we selfed down and selected, you know, through an F2, F3, F4. Some of the first generation we had, we were actually improved over the hybrids in terms of head quality. And these became some of our early generation material that then we started to use for recombination purposes. And I employed over the years, a pedigree method. So we're making a cross. Take the best 2 inbreds we could find, ultimately cross them, or, you know, a whole bunch of crosses. Look at a relatively large F2, make a selection, and then move them through several generations down to ultimately about F7, 8, 9. And we really used a shotgun approach over the years. we make as many crosses as we could. We don't need a lot of seed to look at an F1. So, you know, if we could get 30 or 40 seed all generated by hand pollinations, that would be enough to just to take a look to see if that might be a new F1 that we could then start another round of recombination. So it's really a shotgun approach. But, and just to sort of summarize how we have, what we evolved to is a conventional pedigree method. 4 to 5 new F2 populations per year. So we have a limited number of populations being examined. Select among individuals within families. We have to, because it's a not a good environment, it's very rough, and then we get into very wet conditions, so we have to get plants out of the field. We can't leave them there. Test about 50 to 75 new crosses each year, and some early generation crossing at the F5, and we continue selfing up to the F8, F9. So this is just a quick, this is a very fast crop. So if you look, that's days from transplant and maturity. The summer in 2017, you're looking at less than 50 or almost less than 50 days to go from transplant to maturity. It's our material in the yellow is not so different in the fall. Generally, a more conventional, like Iron Man, doesn't head but 90 days in the fall. Castle Dome and Gypsy make ugly heads. They take a little longer in the fall, but in general, so if you look at quality, we rate on a 1 to 5, 5 being high, excellent, 3 being marketable. We're getting into the now the marketable range. And more importantly, what happens with ours are the quality is not very different in the summer versus the fall, whereas you're looking at all the commercial material that's available has relatively poor quality in the summer but very good in the fall. And importantly, on the bottom is an inbred, which one of the hardest things was to get an inbred that actually does well in the fall and in the summer. We were getting things that would do well in the summer, but they were not doing actually as well in the cool. And so on the right is the same inbred in the summer field versus the fall. So I'm just not going to say too much, just that we've done some genetic studies now to try and, in the last several years, try and pick apart what are we looking at in terms of complexity of the trait. And we've got the luxury of developing double haploids, so rather than look at segregating populations, F2, F3, we're looking at double haploid populations. But here you only have that one chance for recombination. And we use like a heat tolerance scale we've developed, evaluated a double haploid population of about 160 lines using genotyping by sequencing. And this is a study that's been published. We did a second study with a different population, which is smaller, but here we're doing like a bulk segregant, looking for differences between a bulk of good and bad. And basically what we've identified up to this point are 7 QTLs on 6 of the 9 chromosomes, with chromosome 9 having 2, and we think this is probably, we know there's a lot of things going on in terms of flowering on chromosome 9. So I'm just going to conclude there. Heat tolerance in broccoli is a complex trait, and progress and improvement has been slow and incremental, but effective. You have to be very patient and have plenty of time. We have identified 7 novel QTL found in our lines developed through genetic studies. 2 most recently we've identified do not co-locate with previously identified 5. And candidate genes include heat shock proteins and, very importantly, flowering genes. And now one last caveat is, because we've been doing essentially a recurrent selection program with a limited gene pool at the start, we have effectively seen some inbreeding depression within our population. So our best hybrids are not as vigorous compared to a lot of commercial materials. And that is one drawback that we're facing, and we're trying to bring in new material to overcome that. And there's been quite a few people involved in this. I'm not going to say much more. And my original hypothesis over many years is proven correct, I believe. Thank you.